You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 40. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, a podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, doing another episode of FUD Busting today. This time though, not solo. My buddy Clark Moody is joining me and we are talking about the 21 million cap. Clark, welcome.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, I'm always glad to have you on. So, just so we're all on the same page, let's discuss what the 21 million cap is and then maybe what people have problems with it, and then we'll just kind of tear that apart.
Yep. So the 21 million cap is a ultimate limit on the money supply of Bitcoin. It is the byproduct of the inflation schedule that started with 50 Bitcoins per block every 10 minutes, and then after a period of 210,000 blocks, or roughly 4 years, the inflation schedule drops in half to 25 Bitcoin, and that's what's called the halvening by the community.
Wait, is it halving or halvening?
I say halvening. It's more of like a...
It's like a Ron Paul, like, it's happening.
It's happening. It's halvening. Yeah, yeah. Like the happening, right? Anyway, so the halvening happens. We've had two of them so far, which means that we're at 12.5 Bitcoin every 10 minutes in monetary inflation. So supply inflation. Now, if you divide this increase in half again and again and again, you asymptotically reach a peak of 21 million. It just so happens that you get the first half of the money supply out by the time of the first halvening. So the 50 Bitcoin times 210,000. 210,000 is 1/100th of 21 million, right? Or 1/10th of 21 million. So you get 10,000 or 10,500,000 Bitcoins out in the first 4 years, so a full half of the supply. And then after that, the next 4 years, you get a quarter. The next 4 years, you get an eighth, a 16th, and it goes and goes and goes until it reaches and just touches that 100% at 21 million. Now, this is enforced in the code of the block validation code. So in the Coinbase transaction of a block, the miner prints the new coins and sends new coins to themselves and the rest of the network. As it validates that block, it checks whether that amount of coins in the Coinbase transaction is equal to or less than the new coins plus the transaction fees within the block. So the miner gets the fees, the miner gets the new coins, and it just has to be less than that amount. So there is actually a couple Coinbase transactions out there that gave less than the whole amount that they could have, which means that the eventual supply of Bitcoin is permanently below the 21 million. There's a really great article on the Bitcoin Wiki.
Okay.
With these details.
Send that to me. We'll link that. So the miner chose to have a lower reward?
That's right.
Okay.
I think the first one may have been for one Satoshi less than the 50.
Just to prove.
Just to show, right? Just to see if it would be valid. I believe that recently a miner forgot to put a large chunk of the reward, potentially. Maybe the whole reward, like 12.5 coins or something. Which is an expensive mistake.
Yeah.
It also happens that this logic. So you know, the halving happens once every 4 years. So it's kind of a big milestone event in Bitcoin. I envision, you know, parties and stuff happening in the future, like Pizza Day and things, which are annual. But the halving is once every 4 years, and at the first halving, a few of the miners printed 50 Bitcoin blocks
afterwards
that were rejected.
Okay.
So some of the miners may not have actually been running full nodes, full validating nodes, just some sort of mining type of hack, a hacked node. Some of them may have been purposefully testing the cap and saying, well,
let's see if it's actually going to happen.
Let's see if it'll happen. We are used to our 50 Bitcoins rewards that we're getting. We like those. Let's put it to the test and see if we can keep getting those.
Right. Which is why running your own full node and the consensus mechanisms matter.
That's right. Because even though you're not mining, if you're still running a full node, you are enforcing the rules that you want, which is incredibly important for this whole system to work, is that each person decides independently which software they'll run, and they'll follow the rules of that software. And if enough people are following the rules, then miners can't bend those rules because
right.
they won't be accepted by the rest of the network.
Cool. I don't know if y'all hear those birds. We're on location at an undisclosed location. it's beautiful out here. Anyway, this big fish jumped earlier when you were talking. I was a little bit distracted. Anyway. Okay, so then what are some things that have people either proposed to go beyond the 21 million cap, changing it, or doing away with it entirely? I mean, some of this goes back to the episode I did on deflation, and just to be clear, on that episode, we are not currently in a deflationary period. We are in a limited inflation that is decreasing with every happening, whatever.
Yeah, real quick before we address that, I've got some numbers I ran.
Okay.
The really cool thing about Bitcoin supply is that it's known a priori. Unlike a fiat money, which could be printed on a whim anytime.
Yeah.
In any quantity. Bitcoin is known a priori, and so we can know the theoretical inflation rate at any time in the future as well. So I just ran the numbers on at each halvening, what is the forward expected inflation? So going from that point, 1 year in the future, you know, inflation rate is kind of an annual number. And so, first of all, right now, we expect 3.7% inflation of the supply over the next year. And right now, we're in the third phase. We've had two halvenings, so we're in the third epoch, which is 12.5 Bitcoins every 10 minutes. Once we reach the next halvening in early 2020, that inflation rate drops instantaneously to about 1.8%, which just so happens is less monetary inflation than gold. So if everything goes to plan, Bitcoin becomes as sound, if not more sound, than gold as far as the resistance to the stock-to-flow ratio and its resistance to supply increases, it's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And at that point, I don't know what we are. I mean, what is it now? 3.75. And so what, the Fed targets 2 to 3% in theory?
Price inflation.
Okay.
So Austrians would say there's only one type of inflation, and that's monetary inflation, and it will manifest itself in price inflation at some point. The Fed targets price inflation because of a misguided economics about we need a growing price inflation, we need growing money supply to handle a growing economy. It kind of sounds good in kind of a kindergarten economics type way, but it's not really true.
Sounds good, doesn't work.
That's right. Another couple stats. So this is February 18th, 2019, when we're recording. There are 563,000 blocks, 17.5 million coins, and 83.5% of the whole supply of Bitcoin is now out there. So that's kind of where we stand at this point. Reasons to keep the inflation schedule are that it it takes us into territory we've never been to before in history, really, of a truly scarce good that is not a unique good. So, like, there, you know, fine art is a scarce good. There's only so many Picassos and Renoirs and whatever.
Right.
And those fetch higher and higher and higher prices, but they're not fungible. They're not circulating medium. They're a collectible. They do serve as a store of value, store of wealth for collectors and people needing to get out of the inflationary system and launder money, et cetera, et cetera. But fine art is not money.
Right.
Bitcoin.
And fine art is also not divisible.
Fine art is not divisible. That's right. It doesn't have properties that make it money. Bitcoin is meant to be money, and it's divisible, it circulates, it's fungible, and it's scarce. And it's digital scarcity, which we've never seen. So the whole economics of the internet is one of abundance, is one of zero marginal cost to produce additional unit of a good. Bitcoin is kind of the opposite of that. So we're going to this unknown, untried realm of monetary economics, of truly scarce, limited supply money. And I think that's an experiment worth trying.
Yeah.
That's one reason to keep the cap, is that it could have untold beneficial effects for humanity as a whole. I mean, no joking aside, this could be one of the pivotal moments in the history of humanity.
Sure. Like the Industrial Revolution or the Agricultural Revolution.
Right. Separation of money and state, one, but also a scarce digital good that you can save for the future that can't be inflated away.
Right.
The value of it can't be inflated away. Now... the arguments for permanent inflation have to do with incentives within the system. So far, the incentives have been miners get rewarded with new coins for performing proof of work. So the idea is, well, if the block reward goes away, there is no further incentive for them to continue mining because they're not getting the inflation. They do get transaction fees.
Right.
And so this is the big, big argument, is whether the transaction fees will be enough to incentivize the mining in the future. And transaction fee pressure requires usage of Bitcoin, requires people wanting to add transactions on the blockchain. And it also requires a price level of Bitcoin that makes those fees valuable enough to pay your bills.
Right.
Which for the foreseeable future will be paid in fiat money. Okay. So at a certain price level, any level of fees are enough. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
At a low enough price level, the fees may not be enough. And hash power will start dropping, as we saw recently. Even with the inflation, we saw a recent price crash in late 2018, early 2019, and the hash power declined.
It took a while for the hash power to decline, though.
That's right, because, I mean,
if you consider where we were at a year ago until, hash power didn't start declining until November or something like that?
Right, because mining profitability was so high
that
hash power hadn't fully caught up to the price. And so hash power lags price.
Right.
It doesn't lead price. So this is not so the labor theory of value says the amount of work you put into a thing gives it value.
Right.
But no matter how much work I put into making a buggy whip, it will never command the value it once did when we had a horse driven economy.
Right.
You have to do something useful with your work, and it has to be demanded by the market. So the hash power doesn't drive the price. It's the other way around.
It follows the price as the price goes higher, miners, more people want to mine to get that coin, and existing miners buy more equipment to try and command a bigger chunk of the hash power to get a bigger reward.
And it's easy. Understanding mining is similar to understanding oil production. So it doesn't matter if I stick my drill in the ground and try to pull up some oil, that's not going to change the price of oil because I put work into it. If I start selling my oil on the market, that will increase the supply, decrease the price. If I withhold my supply from the market, that'll increase the price, but I'll stop making money.
Right.
So it's the same thing. As the price of oil drops, certain producers can't continue operating, and they turn off their wells, and that has a correcting effect on the price of oil. With Bitcoin, as the price moves independent of the miners, they turn on and off their rigs in order to capture that profit. And they have their fixed costs, they have their financing costs, they have their operational costs. And so it costs money to produce, and there's always the marginal producer that's going to get going to start losing money at a certain price level. So what we saw in the big run-up of 17 was that mining couldn't keep up with the price. Price moved so high so fast that it took a long time to get mining hardware online to capture those profits. And they may have still not caught up all the way by the time the price crashed below $6,500 or so. We saw people turning off. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So then the idea for people who say, well, we can't have a hard cap because then we won't have enough incentive for miners to secure the network, which leads to an insecure network. But could we not just, I guess it's all kind of dependent upon the hash power, but I mean, could you not just wait for more transactions or more confirmations? I mean,
if the network is more insecure, you wait for further confirmations for settlement, basically.
Right.
It could be by the time, so depending on the price of Bitcoin,
right,
any level of fees is enough. So if Bitcoin is $1 billion a coin and you have half a Bitcoin worth of fees, you've probably got enough money to secure the network, probably enough value.
Yeah.
So all this stuff depends on the price.
Yeah.
If the hash rate is dropping, then you wait for further security. Another thing, though, is if Bitcoin is used widely, potentially globally as a money by many societies, there could potentially be just straight mining infrastructure as a strategic asset, not to acquire the coins, but to secure the money. So it could be that there are large projects to continue. They're just a pure expense to continue supporting the hash power of the network.
So you think is like, as we see these bigger financial institutions come online and start offering exposure to Bitcoin, do you think any of them will have a, you know, maybe a small mining farm or something like that as a way to help secure the network and secure their investment?
Potentially. I mean, think about an alternate world where anyone accepting Bitcoin in any capacity, any business accepting Bitcoin definitely wants to run a full node.
Yeah.
Why not have a small mining farm that's adding security to the network on a per company basis?
Yeah.
Where they're contributing, they see it as a cost center. You know, this is the cost of having Bitcoin. We're just going to run this node at a loss, run these miners at a loss, but it's contributing to the security of the network. And if every corporation that was bigger than, you know, $1 billion market cap did that all around the world, that would probably be enough to secure Bitcoin for commerce, because they're not miners. So all they want to do is secure the money. If they were miners, they would want to alter the money to give themselves inflation. Right?
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
The other thing is that it could be a governmental strategic asset.
Yeah.
So states could run farms as a strategic move. So they're going to get some Bitcoin from it while there's still inflation, they're going to get some fees from it, but it's also just securing the money against attack in kind of an adversarial sense.
Yeah.
So I hypothesizing now that, we have to add permanent inflation now because it's not going to be enough in the future, is quite a crystal ball.
It's kind of arrogant to assume that you know what's going to be in the future.
Right.
Because if you had asked somebody in, 2011, when was the Lightning Network paper written?
14, maybe?
Yeah, so we didn't, not that people hadn't envisioned maybe side chains or something like that, but the Lightning Network as it is today, people didn't, and that's, just a few years versus, we're looking how far out?
Decades.
Yeah.
Decades. Now, so. The inflation rate does drop quite low, quite quickly.
Yeah, so I guess it doesn't, this question doesn't have to wait until we hit the 21 million cap, but.
Right. But this is a scarce digital good. Even now in the depths of the bear market, the blocks are not full, but they're over 1 megabyte, I believe. I should have looked this up, but I think we still have solid usage on the network. Usage has been going up even in the depths of the bear market. And so if demand for Bitcoin continues to be constant, then the price will increase because of the decreasing inflation rate. If the demand of Bitcoin grows in the face of decreasing inflation, then the price grows even more. So it's a scarce digital good. There's not enough Bitcoin for every billionaire in the world to have one, or whatever the number is. It has to have a whole Bitcoin. So who knows? Who knows where the price goes long term? And then remember, price is all that really matters as far as how secure the network, the incentives the miners face with the transaction fees. At the height of the fee crisis, which some people are calling it, in 2017, some blocks had fees that were greater than the 12.5 Bitcoin reward.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, I just don't think it's... What am I trying to say here? I know that people don't want to pay high fees, and I get that there is a part where you go, the fee to get this into the block is high enough that I don't want to... It is a substantial chunk of what I'm actually trying to transact, and there is a disincentive to send it at that time, but... Then we get into time preference, right? I just don't see it as that big of a deal, that big of a problem. If it is worth it to you to get it done fast, pay a higher fee. And if it's not, pay a lower fee and wait. And sometimes you're going to want it faster, and you're just not going to have enough. You're not going to be willing to spend enough to get it in faster, and that's just the reality of how the network works. I just don't see that as a problem worth... freaking out over and calling it a crisis.
Right. This also drives layer 2 adoption.
Right.
So the fees conserve the limited resource of block space. Like you said, there's always the marginal spender who needs this transaction in, and they're willing to pay the fee. So if that drives higher valued transactions to the chain and lower valued transactions off chain, that's great. So during the block size debate, it was like, no one needs to know about your coffee purchase for the next 1,000 years. Put that off the chain.
Right.
Settle your lightning channels to the chain once every year and move on. So the economics of the system are complex and super interesting. And we've seen lots of these different things play out. We saw with the Bitcoin Cash hard fork that the hash power followed the price. Like clockwork.
Yeah.
As one coin pumped or crashed, hash power would move toward or away from that coin. Definitely the opposite of the labor theory. It basically disproved the labor theory immediately for Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Who Real knew? World evidence.
Real world evidence. It's just pure incentive.
Yeah. Okay, so while we're talking about Lightning anyways, kind of in a similar vein as what we were saying earlier, there are people who, and we're kind of dancing all around this hard cap thing, but that's fine. People who go, well, if everybody's transacting primarily on Lightning, is there going to be enough demand for on-chain transactions? Kind of in the similar vein of, will there be enough demand for on-chain transactions to keep the fee market, you know, established enough to keep the miners incentivized to secure the network?
Right. I mean, in the same vein as, you know, higher valued transactions going toward the settlement layer, it makes me think of, you know, financial institutions settling accounts on the chain. So I think there will always be demand for the most secure digital ledger, right? It's just at what level on the financial scale does that demand hit? So if everybody pulls their transactions off for coffee, great, because that opens up block space for higher valued transactions, which potentially, you know, maybe some firms were looking at Bitcoin and they're like, well, it's going to cost us a lot in fees to operate this thing. But as the block space gets cleared out of lower valued things, then it becomes viable for different business models to settle to the chain more often with higher valued stuff. The other side of it is the fee to get on the chain relative, you know, for a large amount of money is so much smaller than the fee to move that amount of money in the physical world.
Right.
That it's always worth it. Like, yeah, moving gold, you know, there's always all the stories about moving gold where the plane crashes or gets hijacked or it costs, you know, the ship sinks or it just costs, you know, $10 million or whatever to move $1 billion worth of gold. Whatever it is, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of people and a lot of money, and there's a lot of risk involved.
Yeah.
And you can move $1 billion on the Bitcoin blockchain for what? Say the fee's $100. $100.
Even say it's $500.
$500.
Like, for $1 billion, yeah. Guarantee, I mean, you're going to spend more than that securing. Okay, so do you know about, like, Texas trying to repatriate its gold or whatever from, I don't know where it is, upstate New York. Somewhere? Yeah, so, like, Texas has got a, for those of y'all that don't know, and I'll try and find a link and put it in the show notes. So Texas has gold that it owns, but it is stored, I think, somewhere in upstate New York, something like that, in this, you know, secure vault, whatever. But they are working on building their own facility to house it and get it back, because what they're, you know, what they're saying is, like, what we're spending to keep it stored there and keep it secured there, we could just spend it here or not spend it, you know, have it be an incorporated cost in the cost of the state, whatever. But it's like this multi-year long process of getting the facility built and going through all of the legal frameworks to get it moved out. And I feel like it's just a Fast and the Furious movie waiting to happen of, like, when we actually transport that back to Texas. But yeah, I mean, like, what is being spent on that versus, like, just doing it digitally?
Yeah. And the most paranoid, cumbersome cold storage scheme is definitely cheaper to implement.
Oh yeah, like,
than a crazy physical vault building. Sure, even if you have vaults, you just use bank vaults, you use 7 of 15 multi-sig with people all over the world, but all they have to do is, like, sign a digital thing. Boom, the funds move on the blockchain. You don't need to build a concrete bunker.
Yeah.
And spend this multi-year procurement process and all this stuff. So the exchanges, some of them don't, but many of them do have really awesome cold storage set up.
Not Quadriga.
Correct. Sorry. Some of them have really strong protections in place, and there will be lessons learned and really good consulting to come out of this for institutions to secure their funds.
Yeah.
Another thing, going back to the 21 million cap as a side note, during the fork bonanza of 17, there was the popular FUD that forks negate the cap.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Okay.
A fork of Bitcoin adds to the total supply of coins because now you have 21 million Bitcoins and 21 million Bcash coins and 21 million Bitcoin Private and LMNOP and whatever, all the other forks that that tried to follow on. Well, that's wrong because those are separate blockchains. Those are not Bitcoin. So the supply of Bitcoin is limited to 21 million. And if you're on a forked chain, it's not Bitcoin. So that's the end of that. Somehow these FUD narratives just seem to get out there, which is why we need FUD busters.
Right, right. Well, so that kind of gets into, I think that's on one of the sides on, so if you guys haven't listened to the other FUD busting episodes, we're going off of sides of Nick Carter's FUD dice, the original, the black version, but he's got a new version out, this blue version. It's on, you can find him on quinsolo.com. I'll put a link in the show notes, but I think one of the sides for the new ones, let's see, where is it? Yeah, forks inflate is one of the sides.
There it is.
We're kind of already covering that one a little bit then here. So I got to get me some of these new ones. Anyway, more material. Thank you, Nick Carter, for being an indirect supporter of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin by providing more material. Anyway.
That's right.
And thank you, Keynesians and mainstream journalists, for providing the FUD to inspire these dice.
If we didn't have the Keynesians, we wouldn't need Bitcoin. So thank you.
Right, right. Okay, so yeah. So like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It seems so obvious from this side of it that like these are not the same thing. So sometimes it's hard for me to sit down and explain why it's not, because it's different code, it's different consensus mechanisms. It's just, this is not Bitcoin. And I don't know, they don't get it.
So, you know, the big bet out there is when one of the Bitcoin forks will lift their supply cap to add permanent inflation. So we'll see when they reach their halvenings, we'll see if they lift those caps for their Keynesian reasons.
So here's the other thing. Some of the other, it was discovered that some of the more private coins had some secret inflation going on recently too. Thoughts?
Yeah, this is a really interesting point. When you have a cryptographically shielded confidential transaction, you can't verify that the amount sent doesn't violate the inflation rules of the system. So this is kind of a big argument for keeping Bitcoin non-confidential, keeping the ledger open.
Right.
Which I think is a pretty compelling argument, because this crypto that they're using for, you know, ZK snarks and these sorts of things, like any little bug can create undetectable inflation, which will only manifest itself long term in increasing price levels, because someone has the ability to basically to print.
Yeah.
And so having an open ledger is huge.
Yeah, I remember the first time when I read about it's Zcash, I guess, right?
Zcash and I think another one had an inflation bug.
But yeah, when I first read about Zcash, and I was just going, it sounds nice, but I don't understand how you prevent, if you can't tell how much is there, I don't understand how you prevent inflation, which to me, like
the cryptographic primitives, you just, the cryptographic assumptions of the system, like Mimblewimble coins have this.
Okay.
It's some sort of proof. It's a range proof that's cryptographically secure, that you trust that the crypto works in a bug free way. And that's the key. It's like the cryptography has been mathematically proven to work. It's the implementation that could have the bugs.
Okay.
Bitcoin Private was the one where they printed a bunch maliciously.
Okay.
Like a big solid pre-mine sitting in the secure enclave. So that's a huge argument just for transparency of the ledger, which is not the greatest for the fungibility privacy angle, but there are other solutions to try to achieve that.
Yeah, I mean, you can do coin joins. You can do, Lightning has a certain amount of privacy. I'm open to the arguments, but for me personally, I think that I would rather have, I would rather work on privacy and fungibility on individual wallets or second layers and keep the base layer more open and accountable by anybody. Because if you lose the accountability and if you lose, I'll be honest, like if at some point enough of the network says, sure, let's remove the hard cap, I will consider Bitcoin kind of a failure.
I think so. I think that a hard fork, it would take a hard fork.
Sure.
I think that if we abandon that limited supply principle, then we've kind of shown that maybe humanity isn't actually capable of keeping a promise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a slap in the face to everyone who either mined or acquired or bought Bitcoin prior to that with the intention or the assumption that it would have a cap, because the cap limits the supply, which gives it the value in the first place.
That's right. That's right.
If you've been listening to the show recently, you'll know I launched BitcoinMeritBadge.com, an online store where you can buy Velcro-backed patches to celebrate accomplishments and culture in Bitcoin. It's a great way to support my work and show off your love for Bitcoin at the same time. But what you might not know is that my manufacturer, Patcheon, is also a Bitcoin-friendly business. Patcheon has been accepting Bitcoin since 2011 and accepts on-chain and Lightning Network Bitcoin, as well as a handful of other cryptocurrency payments. Patcheon will work with you to build custom embroidered patches to fit your need, including various backings like adhesive and Velcro. There's no minimum order, so whether you want a big patch or a small patch, one or 1,000, Patcheon is your stop for custom embroidered patches. Check them out today at patcheon.uk.
Okay, so what about people who are not maybe in Bitcoin right now? They're kind of on the periphery, but as Bitcoin continues to expand, kind of get forced into Bitcoin, but they have these Keynesians or even socialist tendency. I mean, you see the rise. I'm shaking my head and I don't understand it, but I continue to see the popularity increase of Ocasio-Cortez. Like, I don't get it, right? But she's popular. People love her. I don't get it, but people love her. So when something like that happens and they start trying to push these Keynesian, which is just like soft socialism to me, ideas, and they're trying to... Now, I mean, at some point, it's like, you can't force me to run a node that runs your socialist code, but, you know, what... do you think there will be outside social influences to try and push this idea?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean... The inflationists have a long, flowery history of putting inflationary systems in place because, you know, more money equals more prosperity for all, et cetera, et cetera. It's always a disaster. It always hurts the little guy the most. It always enriches the few who are on the inside, you know, classic socialism. So they'll try for sure.
Yeah.
The thing is that Bitcoin is kind of the ultimate individualistic money. It's kind of like, these are the rules of the system. You cannot change them. The let's say collectivist progressive agenda is always social change from the center. They want a center to control, and they want to force social change upon the rest of society from the center for our own good.
Right. Sure. Obviously we don't know what's good for us. They do.
That's right. But Bitcoin has no center, which will be incredibly frustrating for many collectivists, because there's no center to control. There's no lever to pull. It just is. And this is a this is something that many, many people will have to come to grips with and be frustrated by. But it requires, you know, I will not run a node that has permanent inflation, let's say.
Agreed.
And either you have to force me, right? Or there will be a fork. There will be the original Bitcoin fork that enforces the hard cap, and people will keep running that one. If it requires a proof of work change to you know, if the miners move away for a permanent inflation, it'll require a proof of work change probably. And we'll see if that lasts. Bitcoin would probably be a pretty strong failure in that case. But we could continue the original chain, right? You could continue running with the original rules minus a hard fork for a difficulty change, a difficulty adjustment, proof of work change, and keep chugging along. All in an opt-in, all in an opt-in manner.
Yeah.
Right? A voluntary manner. So the inflationists will come. The inflationists will want to force change. They'll bring out all of the academics, all of the apologists. Will say, look at all of our models. Look at all this stuff. We have to have inflation or the system won't work. But even think about the system we have is geared toward an inflationary system, inflationary money. If you change away from that, things will have to change. Every change produces winners and losers. So, you know, you just, so far the changes have been toward enriching a small few at the expense of the many. And perhaps we need some changes that take privilege away from the few.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, they deny that, though, right? Like that it's the central planners and things act like they're not, they act like, oh, capitalism is the thing that creates winners and losers. And then the reality is that any kind of decision or, well, okay, actually, to push back on that though a little bit, like if it's a totally voluntary transaction, both parties voluntarily agree to it, you know, there can be regret later, but you're not producing a winner and a loser in that transaction, right? I mean, in a free exchange.
And sure, I mean, and you know, one party maybe under duress, let's say.
Okay.
Right. Like, I'm bleeding and you have Band-Aids. You know, I need Band-Aids, right?
Right.
But it's not a one-time game. So like, you're talking about the price gouging, let's say. If you gouge prices in a time of a crisis, there will be good economic effects, but bad social effects.
Right.
Like price gouging is highly unpopular. You may go out of business after the crisis subsides, because people don't understand economics. A lot of economic realities are not compatible with kind of human social norms, let's say. Like price gouging makes perfect economic sense, but it's very, very bad in a social sense. And you may be punished after the fact by people boycotting your business. Oh, you gouged prices during the time of the crisis.
Right.
And
it's hard to explain to people that in the moment, it's hard to explain to people, you know, trying to grab water for, you know, the impending storm that, hey, by increasing prices, I'm ensuring that the water goes to where it needs to go so that, you know, your family doesn't buy like four crates of it. You buy what you need, actually, and then it's able to go to more people.
But it's like you got gas at $20 a gallon versus not getting any gas at all when the pump went empty after the first five people that went through.
Right.
So you had gas.
Yep.
Versus having no gas. So right. It's hard for people to understand that, though.
Yep. Do you think, while we were kind of talking about, I thought about this when we were talking about the socialist policies and stuff. I don't think it'll happen, but. If things like the proposed Green New Deal go into effect, do you think they will regulate mining in the U.S.?
I don't know. I think they'll try. the mining environmentalism is probably the first political backlash against Bitcoin. I think it'll be mining first, the wealth distribution second, and then 21 million cap third would be the order of the attacks. But it, you know, all they can do is drive it out of the U.S. and drive jobs and drive innovation and drive, you know, tax revenues, let's say, out. It'll still happen.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's kind of the beauty. It's like, it's not going to kill Bitcoin. It's just going to kill it for the U.S. potentially.
The first New Deal had disastrous economic consequences for the country.
Sure.
So I don't expect the second one to do any better.
Right. Yeah, man. Anyway. Okay, let's see. We are at right about 45 minutes. I think that's good. Okay, anyways, to sum up, 21 million cap is a product of the supply schedule decreasing, and it is good because it gives us a scarcity and a controlled or a fixed supply, or we know the end supply, which gives it value. And run your own full nodes, accept no other. Forks don't inflate.
That's right.
All right. That seems like a good place to end.
Yep.
Okay, that's going to do it for this FUD-busting episode. I hope that was informative, and if not, I hope it was at least entertaining. Before I go, I want to thank a new sponsor of the show, BitcoinOnly.com. BitcoinOnly.com is a place where you can go and see lists of projects, podcasts, websites, and more that are only about Bitcoin. This site was created by Twitter user 6102Bitcoin. Bitcoin Only is not really, so it's not about putting any other project down. It's just a place where you don't have to hear about all the other things that are not Bitcoin. The whole point was kind of just to create this distraction-free environment, and you can really see that in his website. So it's very clean. It's simple to use. You easily kind of, there's a main menu, and then you just kind of bounce back and forth between podcasts or wallets or hardware or developer tools or even conferences that are only about Bitcoin, nothing else. And if you look at the list on that website and you think there's a, you know, something missing, you can just DM him at 6102Bitcoin and let him know if you think that something is should be classified as Bitcoin only. So yeah, go check it out at bitcoin-only.com. And always, if you want to support Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the best thing to do is listen to the show and subscribe so you get all the new episodes automatically, and then share it across the internet. If you want to find other ways to support more directly, you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate and keep up with me or drop me a line on social media at bottomshelfbtc, both on Twitter and Instagram. And I'm trying to get back into at least posting something here and there on Instagram. I haven't really been doing much. It's just kind of fallen by the wayside. There's just a lot more action happening on Twitter and not as much engagement on Instagram, but it's there. So I'm going to try and be a little more consistent in my posting there. So anyways, I am really excited about next week. I am doing an episode on Lightning Trust Chain. So make sure you're subscribed because you don't want to miss that episode. All right. From Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.